Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. I'm Lara Prendergast. Each week, we ask a few of our writers to read their piece from the magazine. On today's episode, Cindy Yu explains how China and Russia are getting ahead in the great game of vaccine diplomacy. Fraser Nelson tells us why The Spectator went to court. And Josiah Gogarty asks, how middle class is your dad? First up, Cindy Yu.
At the end of January, the president of Chile, Sebastián Piñera, gave a speech on the tarmac of Santiago Airport. Today is a day of joy, excitement and hope, he said, standing in front of a Boeing 787, which had just arrived from Beijing. Inside it were 2 million vaccine doses produced by the Chinese company Sinovac. It was the first of two similar-sized shipments arriving that month. A few days earlier, the president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, had emerged from COVID confinement to thank a, quote, genuinely affectionate, end quote, Vladimir Putin for pledging 24 million Sputnik doses to Mexico in the coming months. Hopes of vaccinating his country with the Pfizer vaccine had dissipated when supply dried up. Pfizer blamed, quote, global shortages. But here was the perfect opportunity for Putin to play the hero and to send the world a message. In times of need, Moscow, not Washington, saves the day. This is vaccine diplomacy, the new great game. Nations which are hungry to compete with the West, and especially America, are using their homegrown coronavirus vaccines as a way of gaining influence. They are exchanging their vaccines for loyalty and acts of public obeisance. It's not that these are world-beating jabs. Sinovac has had some of the lowest efficacy ratings of any licensed vaccinations, only 50.4% in one trial, and was, until this month, not even licensed for general use in China. It's still not approved for use in the over 60s, which is perhaps one reason why the Chinese don't mind hundreds of millions of doses going overseas. On social media, users frequently joke, other people can have the superior Chinese vaccines, I'll wait for Pfizer. Sinopharm, the other Chinese vaccine producer, can claim 79% efficacy. But developing countries don't have the luxury of choosing where they get their vaccines from if they hope to begin their inoculation programs this year. It's an incredible turn of events. No one has forgotten where this virus came from. Yet a year on, China is trying to present itself as a solution to the pandemic, rather than the origin of it. Some in the West might see this as laughable. For poorer countries, which might otherwise have to wait months, if not years, for vaccines, it's a persuasive pitch. China has been planning this global rollout for months. As early as last summer, President Xi was telephoning King Mohammed VI of Morocco and other world leaders, flogging the then in development jabs and promising that they would be a, quote, global public good. After the world turned against China as the full scale of the pandemic was revealed, Beijing was keen to avoid pariah status. The first phase of the process was PPE deliveries, for which the Serbian president was so grateful that he kissed the Chinese flag. Now it's all about the vaccines. Wang Yi, China's foreign minister, embarked on a nine-nation tour of Africa and Southeast Asia at the beginning of this year, offering jabs and investment for would-be allies. Some of China's customers are predictable, political allies such as Pakistan, which will receive 22 million doses, or booming trade partners like Turkey, 50 million doses. Strongman leaders in particular gravitate towards Beijing's gifts. In the Philippines, where China has donated 500,000 vaccines on top of a 25 million dose order, President Rodrigo Duterte was photographed attentively squeezing hand sanitizer onto Wang's hand. In Zimbabwe, the recipient of much Chinese investment in recent years, a 200,000-dose donation arrived this week. President Mnangagwa declared his country, quote, greatly honoured. Closer to home, the same flag-kissing Serbian President Vucic has managed the second-fastest rollout in Europe, thanks to a shipment of Sinopharm vaccines. And even in the EU, the siren call of Chinese vaccines is irresistible. Hungary has become the first EU nation to approve Sinopharm, and Viktor Orban has even said that he'll choose the Chinese jab over Pfizer for his own vaccination. The Chinese have the longest experience with this virus, so they are probably the best informed, he joked. The first shipment arrives this month. The Russians aren't far behind in the great game. In the patriotically named Sputnik V, no illusions there about how Moscow sees the vaccine, Putin has a better vaccine that is also, polls show, more trusted internationally. A peer-reviewed study published in The Lancet found it 91% efficacious, almost as good as Pfizer's 95%. Moscow claims some 1.2 billion orders have been made, that's almost certainly an exaggeration, by 50 countries and counting. Surveys of Russian propaganda efforts show that Moscow has been targeting Mozambique, Nigeria and South Africa with messages disparaging Sputnik's rivals. Iran is expecting 400,000 doses to be delivered by late March, to the alarm of the country's scientists. An open letter from Iran's medical council complained, "It appears that diplomatic considerations in this vaccine's purchase prevented its standard evaluation." The EU has gone cap in hand to Russia too. The bloc's desperation at 5% vaccine coverage compared with the UK's 24% was palpable in a recent visit that Josep Borrell, the EU's top diplomat, made to Moscow. Borrell appeared willing to overlook Putin's crackdown on opposition voices in exchange for jabs. Sputnik hasn't received regulatory approval by the European Medicines Agency yet, but Hungary's fleet-footed Orbán has ordered 2 million doses already. Merkel is also interested in Sputnik and has offered to help Putin establish production units within Germany. At the height of the Cold War, more than 100 developing countries formed the Non-Aligned Movement, pledging to remain neutral between the USSR and the USA. Then, as now, the great powers did all they could to sway loyalties. With the world slipping inescapably into a second Cold War, it is these swing voters that China and Russia are working on, doing what they can to minimise global support for Uncle Sam. Mexico was already looking to diversify its alliances, a striking move from a long-time US ally. It may well be that Putin will visit Mexico before Joe Biden does. Britain, meanwhile, seems to be using India as a proxy for its international vaccine rollout. The British partnership with the Serum Institute of India, SII, the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, could provide much-needed ballast against China and Russia. The SII is producing Oxford jabs in bulk, and while Britain focuses on inoculating its own population, the Modi government is distributing these vaccines globally with Britain's blessing. So, India is now tussling with China over neighbours such as Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. Indian-made jabs have also arrived in South Africa, but results have been mixed there, as tests have cast doubt in the vaccine's efficacy against the local strain. Meanwhile, Sputnik has already applied for approval in South Africa. For all Putin's progress, it is China that ought to worry the West. It's often said that Beijing's growing influence in the world comes down to hard power, economic arm-twisting and military bullying. Vaccine diplomacy may prove to be the soft power that Beijing has sought for so long. China now hopes that other countries will spread Xi's message. In Belgrade, Vučić did so perfectly. "The world has hit an iceberg," he said. "Like the Titanic, the rich and the richest only save themselves and their loved ones." But China may yet come unstuck. For example, if it turns out that its vaccines do not offer enough protection. When Sinovac's shoddy Brazilian trial result came out, showing 50.4% efficacy, President Bolsonaro gleefully mocked, "This 50% is good, is it?" Bolsonaro is famously anti-vax. On Pfizer's insistence of a liability waiver, he quipped, "If you turn into a crocodile, that's your problem." But he is especially suspicious of Sinovac, quote, "due to its origin." Taiwan has also rejected Chinese vaccines and is now horse trading with Germany over Pfizer vaccines in return for semiconductors. And even the Chinese rate Pfizer highly. A Shanghai-based pharma company has secured 100 million doses of the American-German vaccine. This has led to confusion on social media, with discerning Chinese citizens trying to find out for themselves whether it's better than the homegrown options. When asked to compare Pfizer with the Chinese vaccines, one state scientist replied, "When it comes to domestic cars or imported cars, you'll know which to get. So why don't you know when it comes to vaccines?" Imported cars have long been a sought-after status symbol for bougie Chinese consumers. If there were a genuine choice in a real market, the West would win. Polls show Pfizer and AstraZeneca are preferred to Sinovac and Sputnik. But people will take what they can get. Countries like Peru must wait until September for the AstraZeneca jab to arrive. Outside Britain, no one calls it Oxford. But until then, Peru has been supplied by Sinopharm. For now, the West's benevolence is limited to throwing a little more money at COVAX, the World Health Organization's developing world vaccine scheme, which has struggled to get off the ground. A request from India and South Africa to waive vaccine patents to allow global production has been blocked by America, Britain and the EU, who argue that this would, quote, stifle innovation. A fair point, perhaps, but it doesn't look great to say the least. What's more, it suits the Xi Putin narrative perfectly. During the turbulent years of Donald Trump's presidency, Western politicians often complained that the mayhem in Washington made any multilateral effort to contain China impossible. But Biden is not rushing to reform a Western alliance. He has his own country to vaccinate, his own economy to resuscitate. At the G7 conference in Cornwall this year, we can expect lots of talk about a D10 alliance of democracies formed for the purpose of countering China. But if Britain and the US are serious, they must persuade the world that their friendship is worth more than China's.
That was Cindy Yu. And now, Fraser Nelson.
Did Nicola Sturgeon lie to the Scottish Parliament? A Holyrood committee into the now infamous Alex Salmond affair has been looking into it, what she knew and when she knew it. In its possession is Salmond's explosive written evidence, which contradicts her account. So which one of them is telling the truth? The SNB-chaired inquiry has been in no rush to find the answer. Last month, it made the extraordinary decision not to publish the Salmond submission at all, blaming legal problems. There is a risk, it said, that his account might identify some of the women who complained against him, thereby defying a court order to protect anonymity. Without the key evidence, its inquiry would run into the ground. All very convenient and questionable. The refusal to publish vital submissions fits a pretty depressing trend in the Scottish Parliament. Free speech is already under attack by the SNP's hate crime bill, and journalists trying to get to the bottom of the Sturgeon Salmond mystery are told that there are ill-defined legal constraints on what can be reported. In an SNP-dominated parliament, there is, of course, no means of appeal. There was only one way out. That was to go to the High Court and ask for clarity. Now, the High Court, quite rightly, wants to preserve anonymity for the women, but was its ruling ever intended to halt a political investigation? Challenges are possible, but these challenges cost a lot of money, which raises a pretty difficult question. Who on earth would be crazy enough to blow cash on a court case with a pretty low chance of success? Step forward, Andrew Neil, chairman of The Spectator and holder of the pen which hovers over our chequebooks. So off we went to the High Court in Edinburgh, and last week we successfully persuaded the court to clarify its ruling. Lady Dorian made it clear that the court had no intention of obstructing a parliamentary inquiry or ever stopping a free press from doing its job. And now the Salmond evidence can be told, and the whole story can be released. It was funny to see some muttering afterwards about the London-based Spectator interfering in Scottish affairs. If we hadn't gone to the High Court, they wouldn't have been able to release the document and the story wouldn't have proceeded in the way it was. But set aside the fact that we may be London-based, we were set up by a Dundonian, R.S. Rintoul, in 1828, and his objectives were to campaign for political reform and transparency. The weekly magazine he found is now the world's oldest, and last week it welcomed its 100,000th subscriber. That's quite a landmark, and we figured our lawsuit was as good a way as any to celebrate. Charles Moore gets in touch with a point that occurred to him when he was doing my job as editor. He was 27 years old at the time. Sales, he thought, could easily treble to 100,000 where they are now without the magazine losing its essential character. But after that point, he was worried. Could the Spectator really get to 200,000 sales without sacrificing some of its nature, without becoming conformist, without becoming formulaic? It's a good question. When Boris Johnson was sitting in my chair, he took sales past 60,000, and there was a mixed reaction amongst his colleagues. Mark Amory, then our literary editor, made a remark which has gone down in the folklore history of his office. I can remember, Mark said, when the circulation was just 14,000, and then everybody read it. The speed of Britain's vaccine progress means it probably won't be long until 47-year-olds, like me, get the call. Having had the virus, I'm not so sure my need for a vaccine is the greatest, but I'll certainly take it. But with one reservation, there will be thousands of over-80s all over Europe who are going to die from the virus over the next few weeks. Now, they're going to perish for want of a vaccine that Britain is now set to give to the young and the healthy. My 80-year-old father-in-law right now is awaiting a cancer operation in Stockholm, and he's going to have to take his chances with those hospital-acquired infections. If I could FedEx him a vaccine, I would, but instead I'm going to take my place in the queue. Ursula von der Leyen recently compared Brexit Britain to a speedboat, her words, able to vaccinate at greater speed than the 27-member EU tanker. She's got a point, but once we've protected those most at risk, perhaps our vaccine-laden speedboat might nip over the Channel or the Irish Sea and help our neighbours. There was quite a lot about the European Union that I loved, specifically feeling part of the same family. And I always hoped we'd keep a strong sense of that family after Brexit. I still hope. My own family has expanded recently in a way that I tried to prevent. For some time, my three children have wanted a kitten, which I put down to a form of lockdown madness. But I was then outvoted over breakfast by 4-1, and I'm now pounced on every night by a 2-month-old tabby. We had a name, Apollo, until finding out that he is a she. Now we're stumped. Suggestions for names would be very welcome. As anybody who listens to these podcasts knows, we're forever offering enticements to lure new subscribers. But this time we thought we'd mark our circulation milestone by offering something to existing subscribers, a year supply of Paul Roget. Now, this sparked a pretty difficult discussion here in 22 Old Queen Street. How much bubbly does our average subscriber get through in a year? We decided to negotiate with whoever wins our prize draw. You can enter at spectator.co.uk/Paul. And you can subscribe, well, for once, I'm not going to plug it. Subscribers, this one's for you.
That was Fraser Nelson. And finally, Josiah Gogarty.
Not all Facebook groups are forums for insurrection, anti-vaccine propaganda and rude remarks about Bill Gates. Some are just places where people talk about their dads. Middle Class Your Dad Talk is a group where some 23,000 members share observations and witticisms that all follow the same format. Your Dad is extremely specific about how the dishwasher is loaded. Your Dad judges other success by how big their kitchen island is. Your Dad was building up the courage to confront the postman about leaving the garden gate open, until he saw he had a tattoo on his arm. Mums are generally left alone. The group was set up in December 2015 by Ned Kemp, a 29-year-old who works in criminal law in Bristol. For the first 4 years he wrote the vast majority of posts, and by last January membership had plateaued at 2,000. But during the first lockdown in March, there was a mass exodus of 20-somethings from boxy flats to their parents' houses. Middle-class dads and their children were thrown together again. Those children needed somewhere to vent about it. Thousands joined Kemp's group, which now has nearly 2,000 posts a month. These posts all refer to a host of different middle-class dads. Everyone seems to have a slightly different idea of what middle-class means. But three distinct varieties emerge. One is the metropolitan centrist, who makes his own chutney, learns conversational French on Rosetta Stone, hands out green and black chocolate at Halloween, and reckons that the wrong Miliband got in back in 2010. Another is what Kemp says he originally had in mind. The Volvo estate-driving, gilet-wearing, arga-loving, functioning alcoholic who hasn't put the heating on since the great frost of 1709. This dad wishes you a happy birthday on LinkedIn and owns a British Airways executive club branded wooden cheese board. In April, the day after the anniversary of Margaret Thatcher's death, the defining homage to him was posted. Last night your dad, as he does every year, had a glass of his favourite single malt out on the patio. One for him and one for the Iron Lady. The final dad type isn't really middle class at all, but is a byproduct of the David Cameron philosophy of using the term as a stretchy euphemism for posh, or at the very least, upper middle class. Tatler-haunting socialites cheerily proclaim that your dad's only form of communication is paperwork for your trust fund. And your dad insists his jawline is due to a boarding school rugby accident and not a recessive Habsburg gene. Middle class your dad talk is at its most revealing when members start arguing. It's usually about Brexit. If someone says that your dad declared himself politically homeless following the demise of Change UK, then another will retort that your dad is preparing to celebrate Independence Day and has a union flag at the ready. Your dad, according to this socially schizophrenic community, has both an EU flag and a pro-Brexit slogan on his Facebook profile picture. A neat reflection of how the middle class went to war with itself over the referendum. Not that everyone's an ideologue, Perhaps your dad, like many others, voted Leave to get our fish and sovereignty back, but still goes to Val d'Isère every year. One of the most heated debates about what makes a dad middle class is on the subject of shooting. In November, someone took issue with one of the many posts about your dad's love of shooting. "I don't know where you're from if this is considered middle class," they said. "It's fine to be posh if you are posh, but it just makes for some pretty unrelatable content for us middle-lower class types." Cue a heated debate about the sport's precise social position. 5 years and thousands of posts in, it is clearly a divisive subject in the group. Eventually, there was an intervention from one of the moderators. "We don't like to dictate what activities your dad can partake in. Some middle-class dads might enjoy country pursuits, others are perhaps more suburban in their lifestyles." What the group forces members to do is reflect on their dads and their own position in society. Kemp doesn't consider himself middle-class at all. His actual dad drives a recycling lorry, while Kemp himself is covered in tattoos and likes watching football with a Lidl lager. Neither of Kemp's parents went to university. He says the group has become an unexpected anthropological lesson for him, revealing a multitude of rival metropolitan and home county sects across Britain. But the posts he enjoys most are the ones that transcend the more anxious subdivisions of class. "Your dad asks for your passport back for safekeeping between customs and the airport gate. You're 24.
That was Josiah Gogarty. Thank you for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and do join us again next week.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.